bread.
I'm sorry. Representative Hobson wanted to be here.
Right.
And she said here. In fact, she said later would be better.
Better
would be later.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Ferrioli. For the record, I'm Brian Reeder, the School Finance Office at the Department of Education.
I'm sorry, Brian, I called you Brad.
Welcome.
The 2001 legislature passed a couple of bills requiring studies be done by the Department of Education. The first of those is the study on the cost of operating small schools in Oregon, which I'll talk about first. And then the second was an evaluation of services provided by ESDs and school districts. And that one, I think, logically comes second because in that we address some special education issues, which then I can flow into what Steve will have to say when I'm finished. So I'm going to start in on the small school study. The charge that the legislature gave to us was to conduct a study on a relationship between the size of Oregon's small school districts and the cost and need for programs. And based on the study, the department was to develop recommendations about small school districts. In addition to requiring that study, this came out of Senate Bill 519. 519 also established a fund that made grants to small high schools. So despite the fact that our charge was focused on small school districts, we also took a very close look at the effect of school size, not just district size, because those really are two related pieces, but are different in some sense, because we do have large districts in Oregon that have small schools. So our feeling was that even though the charge was a little narrower, it really the intent was to look at both district size and school size. We had four primary objectives in doing the study. The first was to develop an understanding of the resource needs of small districts and schools relative to larger districts and schools. And also, as I mentioned, to distinguish between the effects of small district size and the effects of small school size, because they may be quite different. The third objective was to evaluate how effective the current small school correction is at directing additional resources to districts with small schools, and then to develop recommendations to improve the efficiencies of small districts and schools. We took three sort of separate approaches to looking at these questions, but I think the approaches complemented each other. The first was to conduct interviews with superintendents, principals, and business managers of small districts and small schools. And most of those interviews were done at what's called the Small School Summit, which took place, I don't remember the month, back in 2001, where I had the opportunity to sit down with representatives of small districts and small schools and really learn as much as I could about the environments in which they operate. The second approach was to develop some small school prototypes similar to the prototypes that are used in the quality education model to try to get a sense for how different the resource requirements are for small schools relative to larger ones. And when I say resource requirements, teachers, textbooks, supplies, all the things that go into running a school. And then the final approach was to use the data that we've been gathering the last 4 or 5 years through the database initiative and estimate what's called an education cost function. And what that does is look at how the cost of running schools varies as different characteristics of those schools vary and different characteristics of students in those schools vary. At the same time, taking into account the output of those schools. And this is an important piece of what we're trying to do here, is not just look at what they're spending, but also look at what they're getting for their money. And we do that by looking at some measures of student performance and relating that to different characteristics of the schools and to the amount of money they're spending. The key findings won't really surprise anyone. What we found is that for high schools, school size has a dramatic effect on the per student costs. If you turn to, see if I can find the page, in the main report, page 16 has a graph that shows how the cost per student varies as school size varies. And this is holding constant all other aspects of the schools. Their student characteristics such as percent ESL, percent special ed, the amount of spending that's going on in those schools. And what it shows us is, excuse me, not holding constant spending, then spending is on the vertical axis here. What it shows is that at very small school sizes, we have operating costs that are 15 to 20,000, even higher. Keeping in mind that that's to achieve a given level of output. We're holding student performance constant here. So this is saying, in order for schools of that small size to achieve the average level of student performance as measured by performance on our benchmark tests, you need to spend that much on a school that size. That cost falls dramatically, falls very quickly as you get up to school sizes of about 400, 300 to 400, and then it flattens out and actually turns up again when you get out to about 1,000 students. And what this tells us is two things. First of all, it's very hard to get your costs down per student if you're a very small school. A lot of your costs are fixed costs when you're running a small school, and your teacher costs, which in a larger school might be considered a variable cost because as the number of students varies, you can add teachers or subtract teachers. But in a small school, they look a lot more like fixed costs because, you know, to offer the full range of courses that high school students want and that their parents think are appropriate, it's very difficult to offer that with a small number of teachers. We find it very rare that teachers are endorsed in multiple subject areas. So if you want to offer science and math and English and social studies, you have to have four teachers, even if you only have 20 kids in the whole school. So the teacher costs look a lot like fixed costs in those small schools. That is really the primary reason that costs per student are so high in small schools. The other striking piece is that there's really nothing to be gained in terms of cost savings when you get to a high school of above 1,000 students. So these mega high schools that we have in some districts, which I think have been in some sense justified in terms of lower costs, really aren't lower cost high schools. You may be spending less on administration in those large schools, less on other things, but other aspects of bigness mean that student performance suffers when you get that large. So in balancing what you're spending versus what you're getting, which is the true notion of cost, there really are no more cost savings to be had when you get higher, when you get larger than about 1,000 students in a high school. We found similar impacts for elementary schools. If you look at page 23, similar shape graph for elementary schools, very small ones, spending $12,000 to $14,000 per student, falling fairly quickly down to the $6,000 range and flattening out. Back up a little bit, take a look at how well the small school correction is compensating for these higher costs. On page 18, we show how this cost function model that we've developed, which is the solid line, compares to the additional resources that the state provides through the formula as a result of the small school correction. As you can see, it does a pretty good job. Those lines are quite close together. In the smallest schools, the small school correction line is a little bit below what the cost function model says are the true costs, and at larger schools, slightly above the cost line. But in general, a very close match. Similar graph for elementary schools on page 24 shows a slightly different picture. It appears that the small school correction is giving more money than the cost function says those schools need relative to larger schools. A note of caution here, though, neither of these lines, well, let me back up. The cost function line, the solid line, does not include transportation costs. So to the extent that the small school correction is intended to compensate not just for small size, but also for higher transportation costs for remote schools, that difference between the two lines might be viewed as the piece going for transportation. One of the recommendations of our study is that the adjustments for size and for transportation, added transportation costs of remoteness, be treated separately because they really do behave in different ways. The first is truly a function of the school size, where the second, the transportation cost piece, is more a function of geography and remoteness, and in some cases those two things don't vary together. They are different. We do have small schools where the student population are quite concentrated and the transportation costs aren't nearly as high as they are for others.
I guess I was thinking that possibly the graph on page 20 loses something in terms of applicability because of the population density, just as you were discussing. If you've got very high dense populations and districts larger than 50,000 individuals, your transportation costs are very low. And so then you point out that this is more of a function of population density and geography than it is any other thing.
Yeah, I think that, in general, very sparse populations are correlated with small schools, primarily in the eastern and southern parts of Oregon. But there are cases where we have small schools in more densely populated areas. So I think it's worth looking into splitting those adjustments apart to get a better fit between the two pieces.
Is this the, I guess you could look at this center column under total enrollment and also see the curve of population density and numbers of districts.
I'm sorry, what page are we on now?
20, if you look at the center column called total enrollment, there's three areas where you've got over 100,000
in total population, total enrollment, and then it forms the typical curve, the bell-shaped curve,
right,
with that being the top of the bell.
Right.
So it looks like for those three categories, that adds up to as many as there are in all the other categories. 350,000 students in those three categories.
Right.
That's more than the rest of the categories combined.
Right. Out of 500, roughly 550. So it's close to two-thirds.
Okay.
We also took a look at how costs vary by district size, independent of how they vary by school size. And if you look on page 25, that graph shows that variation for elementary schools. What we found for high schools is that district size and school size are so highly correlated that you can't separate the effects of those two. So in looking at high schools, in this sort of trying to determine which of those, school size or district size, really was the primary effect, the logic used was that most of the costs that vary dramatically are school-based costs. They're typically teacher costs, which are school-based, not district-based costs, not centralized costs. So our conclusion was that for high schools, it really is school size that's driving the cost variation, not district size. For elementary schools, the correlation between the two is not nearly as high. We do have small elementary schools in large districts, so it allows us to look at those two effects separately. And what this shows us is a similar shape as for the school size variable, but what it shows is that sort of the least cost district size is somewhere around 3,000 to 4,000 students, that there really are diseconomies of scale for very large districts. And also some even more significant economies of scale for the very smallest. Just a final note, we did develop prototype schools of different sizes, and the results of that exercise were quite similar to the cost function results, and you can see that in the main body of the report where we compare those directly. In some cases, the prototype school approach was slightly above. In other cases, slightly below the cost function approach. But in every case, quite close. The two methods were quite close. Just in way of recommendations, to improve the efficiency of small schools and small districts. A number of recommendations have been made for how to improve the efficiencies of small and isolated districts and schools. None of them have really been tested very well. So it's with that in mind that I make these. The first is to develop strategies that really take advantage of the role of education service districts in trying to help those small districts and schools, increase their efficiency by, for example, pooled purchasing of supplies and other materials where buying in larger quantities can result in lower prices. Using distance learning strategies either over VTEL or the internet to to deliver courses to students in those areas where it simply doesn't make sense to try to hire a teacher for the one or two students that may want to take some type of course. Those types of strategies. Some of those things have started to take hold, and I think are showing some promise, more in terms of providing a broader spectrum of course offerings than actually reducing out-of-pocket costs. But by offering those added courses, that is a important contribution to those students' education, whereas they otherwise may not be able to take those courses at all. As I mentioned, try to develop separate adjustments for size versus transportation costs to better fit the circumstances of particular districts. And then the last two is the Full Employment Act for me, and that's to try to incorporate some of these into the quality education model, which I think is a useful tool for evaluating these sorts of questions. And you know, we did develop the smaller school prototypes for this effort here, which I think would make sense to flow those or incorporate those into the QEM. And then finally, to take a look at the weights in the current formula that we have to make sure that, in particular, the small school correction is really sending the appropriate amount of additional resources to those districts and schools.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Corcoran.
Brian, one of the, I wish he was still here. I don't think he is. The ESD head from Douglas County was here today and brought up an interesting dilemma that I'd like you to address, and that is that in North Douglas there was serious discussion of merger between Drain and Yoncalla. North Douglas is Drain and Yoncalla is Yoncalla School District, and you know, for economies of scale they were going to try to merge, and apparently found out that in the process of the discussions that they would forego $250,000, and I don't know if that was a year or for the biennium, because it would change their status, I guess, as small and remote schools. I'm not sure quite where that loss was. But is there a way, I mean, we have 198 school districts. It seems real clear to me, you know, in that part of, I mean, you got Glide, which is way the hell away from everything, so they're probably not going to consolidate, but you know, you got Sutherland right next to Roseburg. You've got, you know, Elkton, Yoncalla, Drain, Oakland. They're pretty isolated, you know. And then in Lane County, you got Lowell, and right next to Pleasant Hill, and right next to Oak Ridge. And it just seemed to me that some consolidation would make sense. That if we could figure out a way to not even necessarily incent it, but to not have a disincentive.
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Corcoran. This question is coming up in a number of places around the state where not only districts considering consolidation, but within a district considering closing one school and sending all the students to another school. And in some cases, the school that they're considering closing currently qualifies for a small school correction, but the combined school would not. Mm-hmm. So they would lose the additional money they're currently getting through the small school correction. In the case of districts consolidating, there is a test in the law. There's and I believe the maximum district size is 8,500 students to qualify, in order for the schools within the district to qualify for the small school correction. So I believe if two districts consolidate and they're still below that 8,500 students, that the schools in the newly consolidated district would still qualify. Now, if the schools are also talking about consolidation, then that may very well eliminate the small school money for the ones that are
closed. Yeah, I think it was the two high schools. Yeah.
And, it has been mentioned, proposed that when that happens, that maybe that money be phased out rather than immediately terminated in order to give the district time to adjust. But beyond that proposal, I haven't heard of anything else. But as the law stands now, if you close a school and a new one gets bigger and goes over the size limit, then they no longer qualify.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On page 22, there's a section about the four-day school week. Could you address that in the report just a little bit?
Yes, Chair Ferrioli. One of the proposals or approaches that districts have used to try and save money is going to a four-day school week, and where each of the 4 days would be a longer school day than they would be in a five-day week. So they're not losing any instruction time by doing that. The intent is to try to save money primarily in transportation costs by only having to transport students 4 days instead of five, but also in some maintenance and custodial and energy costs for the school building itself. I think there's a few districts in Oregon that are doing that right now, and their experience has been that it does save money, but not very much money.
Okay.
You still need to pay your teachers their full salaries, despite the fact that they're working 4 days rather than five. They're working longer days.
Actually, my understanding of this four-day week is that applies to attendance days for students, but not at all the teachers. The teachers, in fact, come to class, carry on a normal working business day without regular class instruction, but they do the in-service work, correction of papers, lesson planning, and so forth. And that the students themselves are invited to attend, if they wish to, do their makeup work and so forth, and that the primary savings isn't in custodial and energy cost, but in not operating the bus system for the day.
I'm not familiar with all how each different district does that, but that may be one of the...
My understanding is that it's several hundred thousand dollars a year in some districts for not operating the bus system 1 day a week. And which is by far and away a more significant savings than building maintenance or energy costs, particularly considering that the teachers are there in the building and many of the students are also there in the building. So I guess I would ask the authors of the report to try to correlate those schools that actually operate 5 days a week but only have 4 days of instruction, and they... And I think you'll find their cost savings are primarily in the area of transportation. But it's not insignificant.
I'll look into that.
Yes. And the other question Steve reminds me is that in this report there's an assumed adjustment for transportation. But in the school funding formula, there is an actual adjustment for transportation. So how do we factor that in?
Senator Ferrioli, I guess I don't know what Steve means by an assumed adjustment.
I was just commenting that for the school district that meets 4 days a week and reduces its transportation costs for that 1 day, but they don't save the full amount. They only save 30 cents for each dollar that they're... transportation costs decrease.
Right, so it's the funding formula share of 30 cents. That's
right, that's correct.
That I guess I was even suggesting that that the small school adjustment in this report is assumed to be making up for the transportation costs when, in fact, there's a transportation allowance of the 30%. So the small school allowance and the transportation allowance, I think, are two different things.
Calculated separately.
So I'm just wondering if we're not seeing a blending of concepts in the report.
Senator Ferriero, that's true, although what we have found is that the 30% share paid by the district that's not reimbursed when combined with the non-reimbursable amount can be a significant amount of money for those isolated schools that are traveling large distances. You know, the non-reimbursable when they do trips for sporting events and so forth can be relatively large, but the 30% share that's not reimbursed also can become a significant amount of money for those districts.
Yeah, and Steve's pointed out that on the graph on page 20, if you're looking at 30% of $1,380, it's a much different number than if you're looking at 30% of $600 or $506. Obviously, there's a huge difference in those adjustments. Any other questions from the committee? I think what we need to do is take this report under advisement, acknowledge that we've received the report, and then study through it for implications for how this may affect the funding formulas. And I assume this was done with an objective in mind. Perhaps you could remind the committee what the objective was when the legislature requested this report to be done.
Senator Ferrioli, the objective, as stated in the law, was fairly general, and that was to conduct a study on the relationship between the size of Oregon's small school districts and the cost and need for programs, and to develop recommendations about the small school districts. Soon that included making recommendations for potentially changes to the formula as it relates to smallness and remoteness, which includes transportation costs.
And are there any particular recommendations contained within the report?
There are. I think probably the most significant one would be to take a look at breaking apart the adjustment for smallness based on the assumption that the small school correction was intended to compensate not just for small size but also for the higher transportation costs of remoteness, that maybe we take a look at those two pieces separately rather than trying to lump them together into a single adjustment in the formula.
Well, I guess I'm confused. I didn't think they were a single adjustment in the formula.
Well,
small and remote is one adjustment, and transportation costs are another, are they not?
Right. I'm working under the assumption that the remote portion, or the term remote in the small school correction,
relates to the
higher transportation costs, that 30% share that's not reimbursed, being viewed as still a significant burden on those districts.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? So small schools cost more, but on the other hand, large schools haven't achieved the efficiencies that were anticipated.
I've read in a number of places that the move to larger and larger schools was based on some proposals made quite a few decades ago that there were cost savings to be had by getting large, but the person making those recommendations was, to him, large meant 300 to 400 student high schools, not 2,000 student high schools. So I guess Americans' penchant for doing things in a big way is maybe taking a little too far in the case of our schools in this circumstance.
Well, I think the graphs on 16 and 23 and 24 and 25 all very eloquently illustrate diminishing returns. And you've got real steep cost reductions as numbers go up. And then you hit the point of equilibrium there, and then costs seem to just about flatline.
That's correct. And these findings, which were estimated based on Oregon-specific data, are consistent with what people have found using data from other states as well. So.
Okay, thank you very much. I guess we have another report to have presented today, and that's an evaluation of ESDs.
I'm not a more lively guy than Mr. Reeder to present him, Mr. Lamentel. This guy could be an economist in the Legislative Revenue Office for all we know.
These are not the most exciting reports, but they are pretty important to us. So. Have at her.
I didn't say what he was saying wasn't important.
Yeah.
I just said it was very dry. That's what I meant.
That's what the Oregonian said, too.
I don't want to be in a position of agreeing with the Oregonian on anything.
Okay. This one was a lot less fun to do than the small school.
Amanda likes his job.
The charge to the department here was to create a comparable definition of services offered by ESDs in school districts, to create a catalog of services offered by ESDs in the school districts, provide a correlation of service costs to a uniform chart of accounts, and then I guess the small piece of fun here was to identify where in the state there are deficiencies in the services offered by ESDs in school districts. We sort of split those four charges into two parts, the first three forming the first part, which is sort of try to understand what it is ESDs and districts do and how much it costs to do those things. And then the second part is, given that, where are their deficiencies? We started by looking at the couple of previous studies related to ESD services, the first one done in 1994, and then subsequently updated in the year 2000. What those two studies essentially did was to simply create a list of things that ESDs do. The list from 1994 was 450 items long, and the list in 2000 was pared down to 350 items. But that essentially was the extent of those studies, to simply list what ESDs do. It didn't really offer a definition of what those services were, nor did it collect any data on how much each ESD spent on doing those various services, or did not try to correlate those services with the services that the constituent districts of the ESDs provided their students. So it really was, the two previous studies were of limited usefulness in really trying to get at the question of what level of services do ESDs provide, and what value is that to the districts and the students they serve. When we reviewed those studies, it became apparent that we really weren't going to be able to relate those lists of services to any expenditures that we currently have, any of the data that we currently have in Oregon. So we, at that point, realized that any catalog or list of services that we developed needed to be it needed to be possible to link that to the spending information that we have in order to say anything meaningful about the services that are being provided. And given that realization, we immediately went to the current chart of accounts that the department uses to collect data through the Database Initiative project. That data is broken down in a number of different ways. The one that's primarily useful in this context is what we call functions. Those are things that districts and ESDs do, such as instruction, transportation, maintenance, administration, that sort of thing. It's the by those breakdowns that we collect the detailed expenditure data that we now collect. And it also it meets another primary objective, which is that it uses the same definitions for ESDs and school districts, so that you're dealing with a common definition of what you mean by services. What we were able to do then, based on the data we've been collecting in the last few years, was to match up each school district in the state with its ESD and then look at the combined spending of both the districts and the ESDs in serving the students that are within the boundaries of the ESD. Major findings of the study, we looked at our primary measure here was spending per student. What we found is that there's quite a bit of variation in spending per student around the state at the district level and also at the ESD level. When you then adjust those for differences in cost levels, and we do that by going to the weights in the state's formula and expressing that spending on a weighted student basis, we find that the variation at the district level essentially goes away, which is what the formula is intended to do, but the variation at the ESD level is still there. We still have a lot of variation in per ADMW spending by ESDs, and that really is a consequence of the way Measure 5 worked in adjusting a combination of the limitations of Measure 5 and the way the state responded to that by developing an equalization formula for districts but not for ESDs. All the variation in spending at the ESD level that was present prior to Measure 5 is still there because until last session when a new formula was started to phase in for ESDs, there was no attempt to equalize ESD spending. I think a couple of graphs sort of demonstrate that. Figure 1 on page 12 shows expenditures per student. That's prior to those are unweighted students, and you can see the variation across ESDs. It's broken into the district piece and the ESD piece. And then figure 2 on page 14 is on a weighted student basis. You can see that the district level variation is substantially diminished, but the ESD level variation still remains. What the formula for ESDs that is currently being phased in will do is essentially equalize the ESD portion as well, and put us in a situation where all of the funding, or all of the funding that flows to the formula, ESD plus district funding combined, will be equalized around the state. What that means, though, is you're going to have less ESD money in a lot of places and more ESD money in other places. The primary conclusion of the report is that that's a good thing, that that is a more equitable way to distribute money if the weights in the formula are appropriate. If they're not appropriate, then we may still have an equity problem. So we also recommend that, as with the small school study, that those weights get a thorough evaluation, something that really has never been done. And I think I'll leave it at that. Actually, let me weigh in on the special ed piece, because that has generated a certain amount of interest, and will also help introduce what Steve is going to say. As part of this exercise, we looked at spending on special education programs in various districts relative to the money that the added money that those districts get through the extra weight in the formula. What we found is some districts spend more than they get through the formula for special ed, some spend less, some spend considerably more than they get through the formula. And from this, we conclude that the formula really isn't capturing the true costs of special education, and the primary reason for that is that there's a huge amount of variation in the cost per student of serving special ed students. Some require very little spending beyond the base allocation that they get through the formula. The base allocation is currently $5,000 per weighted student, and some special ed students may require only 10 to 20% more than that to be served, while others require maybe 5, even 10 times that much to be served. And what we find is that those very high-cost students tend to migrate to larger districts in the state, because it's those districts that have the capacity to serve them. So, for example, Portland has a much higher percentage of the very high-cost special ed students than most districts, and yet doesn't get additional money through the formula for that. And so, as a consequence, end up spending considerably more than they're allocated through the formula for special education. And with that, I'll answer questions and let Steve give you some more interesting pieces.
Question. I've
been determined that I'm not interesting, so I'll
I didn't say you weren't
give it up
interesting.
To
just it's this blandness that accountants and actuarials have, about the extroverted one stare at the other person's shoes and stuff. Those kind of jokes come up every once in a while.
Economists are people that are good with numbers but don't have enough personality to be accountants.
Okay, let me try and rescue some benefit out of this public hearing, because I think these two reports are far more important than the, perhaps the committee's treatment of them to date and the relative interest demonstrated by attendance of this committee would indicate. First of all, on the cost of operating small schools in Oregon, Senate Bill 519 originally created the Small School District Supplemental Fund. And what this shows me, because of these steep cost curves in the front end of these equalization formulas, is that smaller school districts are the ones that need equalization. Those are the ones where we've got the tremendous cost differences. And I'm going to ask that that the committee acknowledge the receipt of the cost of operating small schools in Oregon resulting from Senate Bill 519, and that we receive the report but sort of keep them on the table. I think all the other committee members need to have a chance to review these reports, and perhaps there'll be other questions. So it wouldn't surprise me, Brian, if you were brought back to answer additional questions on that report. With the other report titled An Evaluation of Education Service Districts and School District Services in Oregon, Senate Bill 260 was probably one of the hardest fought and more controversial bills that we had in the last legislative session. And the interesting part of Senate Bill 260 was that people were trying to determine whether it was equalization funding that was at the heart of the issue, or availability of services that was at the heart of the issue. And this is a report that really is dedicated to trying to figure out whether or not it's just raw dollars that make equalization, or whether it should be more particularly an analysis of service availability throughout the state of Oregon. And the whole point of that is, at some point, the availability of services possibly becomes actionable. And if it becomes actionable, we'll see it in court. So I was glad to see the approach that was taken in this report, that services essentially were defined so that they could be comparable. And once we got definitions of services and a catalog of services, we actually linked those services to a chart of accounts so that people could look at this stuff and make those connections between what is being provided under what name and how does that compare to other districts that are doing the same thing. Then the fact that ESDs are not essentially of one variety, that they all have different characteristics and different components. There was analysis of the different kinds of services and characteristics of the ESDs. We still have funding disparity. And I'm pleased to see that the apparent disparity, when you look at just the operating expenditures per student, is great. I'm also pleased to see that when you add the weighting, that the disparity declines. We are headed toward an equivalency of ESD funding within 5 years. The question remains whether or not the deficiencies of services gets us to equity in those districts or doesn't. And that's still going to be on the table. So I'm hoping people look at this report and think about services, how they're defined, where they're available, and where they're deficient. Because even if we're spending an equivalent amount of money in districts to provide services, if the services aren't equivalent, that's still going to be actionable by parents and patrons. So 260 is still, I think, an important piece of legislation. As painful as it's going to be for those districts and ESDs that are losing money. But at the end of the day, equal in funding may not mean equal in services. And that's going to be at the thrust of this issue, whether or not we are at a point where we can say that all the kids, wherever they are in the state of Oregon, you're getting an equivalent education and you're getting equivalent services. If we can't do that, I think we have still the potential for a legal liability to parents and patrons. So we're not out of the woods. I appreciate the report. I think we have a lot more thinking about this to do. So I'm going to go ahead and take the reports on behalf of the committee, which meets the legal requirements of Senate Bill 260 and Senate Bill 519. So let the record show that the reports were received. But I'm going to leave them on the table. Discuss them with the chair and then perhaps ask for additional presentation of these issues, because they're critical to the success of the Revenue Committee's job to equalize not only equity and services but funding for the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So on the special ed piece, the one issue I want to get out on the table is, after 9 years in this, I've gotten the parents of the special ed kids who say that their weighting formula is basically being distributed to help the general population. I have the general population saying that they're subsidizing the special education because there's not enough resources in that area. Mm-hmm. And you seem to indicate that it's the latter, that your findings were that the weighting in special education was not sufficient.
Well, let's move to the next report, because I think it deals particularly with that.
Okay.
This evaluation of education service district and school district services points out that one of the thorniest issues, one of the toughest problems, is special education funding, and a task force met throughout the interim to deal with that particular issue, and they're here to present their report today. And I think it directly answers your question. What are we doing about special education? Can we demystify it? Do we have truth in special education funding? Is it an entitlement, or is it sort of an increment that just goes to schools to sort of fit into the bigger mix? And can we trace those dollars? So let's bring up Steve Johnson and Representative Hobson. You chaired the committee that did the special education interim study, so I'm glad to see you here today.
Just
Oops. You have reduced constraints.
Yeah.
Oh, for
safety.
Yeah, right. And that goes away in all three. If it's just for the same behavior. So maybe we have to do that again. That's your choice. No, it's good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Elaine Hobson, State Representative from District 32, and as you indicated, I did have the pleasure of serving as Chair of the committee to take a look at special education, the task force that did indeed do that. It was a result of Representative Vic Backlund's bill, House Bill 2598. And of great concern, as Senator Kirkland has mentioned, was the funding, but we also looked at a number of other things. And the charge, actually, of the bill was to analyze information and performance, as well as preparing recommendations in the following four areas. And my colleagues here are going to go over those four areas. They were instruction and service delivery, and the chair of that part of the task force was Mike Taylor, who is superintendent of Park Rose. Number two, performance standards, expectations, and accountability. Susanna Ramirez, who is a Salem parent, very active Salem parent, was in charge of that subcommittee. Qualified personnel was chaired by Kathy Kreider, who is the Student Services Director in the Reynolds School District. And last, but certainly not least, was funding and fiscal accountability, which was chaired by Dr. Maureen Casey, the Deputy Superintendent at Willamette ESD. And I'm going to be joined here with Carolyn Ortman, who was the Vice Chair of the Task Force, who is on the Hillsborough School District School Board, as well as TSPC. And before I go over a couple of things, I would like to ask for your indulgence, and I'm going to introduce things, and then I'm running out of here and leaving it all upon my friends here, but they have assured me that's all right. And truth be known, they know as much, if not more, than what I know. Some of the guiding visions that we had, first of all, let me preface that by saying, as good Senator Farioli knows, we had a horrible time getting together. I think went on record one time as saying I was quite sure that the governor looked to see when our task force was scheduled to meet, and that was exactly when a special session was called. So it took us a while to really get underway, but once we did indeed do a lot of good work with the very able assistance of the Department of Education. But some of the things that we scurried through in the very beginning to set some parameters under which we would be operating were the following kind of guiding principles. Number one, our schools serve all students, including students with disabilities. Number two, all students are general education students first. Number three, all students should be educated with the general education population to the maximum extent possible and appropriate. Number four, every student has the right to an education that meets his or her individual needs and provides meaningful educational benefit. Number five, instructional and support services in schools must be based on student needs. Number six, parents are essential members of any group making educational decisions for their child. Number seven, funding and program policies should not create incentives or disincentives for identification of students for special education. Number eight, the costs of educating students with high needs should not create adverse impacts on local education budgets or services to other children. Number nine, special education should be viewed as part of the comprehensive resources available for education, not as a standalone, separately funded program. Number 10, changes in special education policies should not result in unnecessary paperwork or reporting burdens on teachers or on local school districts. Excuse me. And number 11, and lastly, the ultimate measure of schooling is successful participation by the student in post-secondary education, meaningful employment, and social and community integration that reflects self-determination. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I guess that says that my time should be about finished. But I am going to leave this to my colleagues, and they will go over those individual four areas about which we were talking and indicate to you some of the information that we found out and some of the recommendations that we have put forth to you.
And before you leave us today, were you quoting from page 58 under beginning of page 59 under findings of the report?
I would probably have. No, I was quoting from the very beginning. Let's see. Page 2 of the major. I'm not sure it's in the summary. I'd have to take a double. Is all you have before you the summary?
We have the full report.
Oh, then it's on page 2. A guiding vision for the work of the task force. Kind of there, mid page 2.
I guess I was looking in that. Those are the 11.
Kind of the guiding principles, Mr. Chair, that we used when coming up with the rest of the report.
Thank you.
And with that, I have full faith in my colleagues in being able to handle this just fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to have Steve come forward.
Yes.
Do you want to do your presentation first, or do you want us to?
Why don't you go first?
Okay. My name is Carolyn Ortman. I am a school board member in the Hillsboro School District. I am a member of Teacher Standards and Practice Commission representing school board members, and I'm also the president-elect of the Oregon School Board Association, which is the venue that I was appointed through to be on this commission, on this task force. And it was a very spirited and lovely time. As the vice chair, I really thought that I wouldn't have a lot to do, and then you kept doing those special sessions, and I had a lot to do, and it was quite an interesting time. But we did do some really good work, and I was very pleased with what we came out with. As you know, Chair Farioli, you were there for part of those discussions and got to participate in some very thoughtful and deliberative discussion. The first, I'm going to present very briefly the three areas that do not include funding, and then Dr. Casey will present the funding pieces. Instruction and service delivery felt there was a consensus on our task force that schools should operate in accordance with student-centered service models that are characterized by some of the following items: providing educational and support services that are student-centered, identifying student needs as soon as possible, and then to meet those needs through the provision of appropriate services. That it should support general education teachers as the first teachers of all children. That it should meet the student needs on a continuum of services independent of their location of the delivery or existing programs. That it should develop funding and or funding formulas that do not drive identification or services to students with additional educational needs. Also felt that there should be a provision to review the current Oregon ed law and policy to ensure compatibility with these student-centered service models. Also was a recommendation to expand the QEM to include special education programs and services. Under performance standards, expectations, and accountability, Susanna did a great job with this committee. It was very spirited, and I think that some good work came out of it. The recommendations, there were 8 recommendations that came from this subcommittee. The first one was to provide for parent-teacher training in communication, parent-school partnership models that work, through IEP facilitation and dispute resolution methods. Recommendation also included to disseminate information about the continuum of dispute resolution options in languages and formats that all parents can understand. There were a number of requests and recommendations to ODE. They included to actively promote mediation and other early alternative dispute resolution processes, for ODE to measure student and school performance over time, to make those reports public and make them also to stakeholders, to develop key indicators that are compatible with state and federal law to measure special education performance based on statewide norms, to develop a format for publishing statewide data comparing special education performance of school districts against those established norms, to identify desired levels of district performance related to special education performance indicators, and to use those measures to identify areas of focus. The last one from this subcommittee was to have ODE establish a special education secondary transition advisory committee comprised of stakeholders to address transition services, current information, and training for those students as they move out of special ed into and out of school services into their adult lives. The third subcommittee was qualified personnel, chaired by Kathy Kreider. Their recommendations, they have 10 of them. I will just highlight a few of them. They are printed in your book on page 5, and then further details are farther in the book. The first one was to provide for building-level administrative supports to improve retention of special ed teachers. This was a really big issue that as the amount of paperwork continues to become an issue and the amount of time that special ed teachers really don't have with the students and they're doing the other tasks, it's difficult to retain along with all the other issues related to teacher retention, that we really need to have some building level administrative support in that area to train the administrative staff in their role of supporting special ed staff, to develop clear role descriptions for special education teachers and paraeducators, to use mentoring programs, to provide opportunities for special ed teachers to be able to collaborate on a regular basis with other special and general ed teachers, to provide for that comprehensive training and professional development for all teachers and education support personnel. If we truly believe that the general ed teacher is the first teacher of all students as appropriate, to provide special ed training for special ed teachers only goes against that. We really need to provide training for all teachers related to special ed needs. To develop and implement appropriate qualification standards for special ed paraprofessionals, and to use data from the ODE special ed caseload study to help make appropriate decisions regarding some of those issues. To be consistent with the above study, to not legislate or establish through ODE policy pupil-teacher ratios for special ed, and to help establish guidelines for use and training of interpreters in schools. Those are the three areas, and one piece that I would like to make note of is this task force really was very aware of the fact that the funding of this, the funding issues in this state were not going to get any better. And you will note that most of our recommendations are either low or no cost, that they are designed to refocus and rethink how we're doing the services and how we spend those monies. It's, in some cases, shifting of costs and shifting of services, but really looking at what is best for the student. How can we provide that service, and where do we have that currently? And many of those subcommittees felt that they should pass those questions of funding onto the subcommittee of funding. And so I'm going to turn it over to Maureen, who's going to spend the bulk of our time discussing the findings and our recommendations.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Maureen Casey. I'm the Deputy Superintendent of Willamette Education Service District, and I serve not only on the task force but also in the capacity of chair of the funding subcommittee. I'm also a recovering special education professional myself. For many years, I served as a psychologist, a speech-language pathologist, and also a counselor, serving students with special education needs. Two of those three categories happen to be on the endangered species list. There are far fewer of those professionals in the state and in the nation than are needed to provide services in our K-12 districts. In summarizing the work of the funding subcommittee, we wanted to convey to you that there is an overriding fundamental philosophical difference in what we're presenting to you. And the premise is that it permeates all of our recommendations, and that is that historically we've maintained a bifurcated system of special education and general education. And we've had two different systems for administration, in both of those systems, for staff development, for funding and budget planning, for data collection. Our data collection systems have historically been different, and they didn't talk to each other. So our frame of reference going into the study of the funding situation was that we needed to relook at the system and view it not as a standalone, separate system, but part of the continuing overall comprehensive educational system. And then we needed to look at efficiencies that could be gleaned from the difference in the premise that it was one system, not two separate systems. So what did we find? We found that the current funding formula was developed in 1991, and it was based on data from 1989. Since that time, there have been some significant changes in the profiles of the students that have special education needs in the state, and right now we're talking about 71,000 students are currently on individual education plans. We also found that 11% was the statewide incidence rate of students receiving special education in the early 1990s, and that was reflective of what the national incidence was. Right now, the current statewide average is 13%. That also is reflective of the national incidence rate. So it's no surprise that in 161 districts applied for the 11% cap waiver. So this told us that the formula that we are currently using is one where 81% of the districts applied for a waiver for additional funds. We also found that we had an incredible resource, and that was DBI data, that was not available to us in the past. Never before have we had access to such a rich pool of data across districts. It's definitely a strength and a resource. At the same time, it's also a caution because it is so new. And quite frankly, districts are not there yet in terms of the reliability and the consistency statewide in how they report the data. So while we had a wealth of data that we've never had before, we're getting to the point where no longer will you receive answers when you ask for how much does this cost or what's the average cost, instead of saying, well, special education funding is so complex, we can't get at that because there are so many variables. We now are able to look at the variables and control for some consistencies and predict. We need, at the very minimum, this current year data that we generated December 1, and the State Department of Education, the Office of Special Ed, is currently analyzing that data. We need to take that data and add it to the data that was available to us to begin to look at actual trends, because we just didn't have enough years of consistent data to look at. We also found, and you'll, on page 59 is where the findings are listed, we found that expenditures for special education exceeded revenue sources by $56 million, and this addresses Senator Corcoran's question. If you take all of the revenue sources, federal and state, and compared them with the expenditures, it exceeded the revenue sources by $56 million. And that primarily fell on 11 districts exceeded their revenue sources by $47 million. We also found the most significant finding of the study, actually, was that the proportion of students with high needs who receive high-cost services was directly correlated to the amount of funds that a district spent for special education. And the correlation, for those of you who have statistical background was 0.88, that is significant. And that also goes back to the concentrations of these high-need students in areas where services are accessible. So you see that the larger districts are particularly hit by an overrepresentation of the number of students with high needs, high-cost disabilities. However, by the same token, you'll have very small, rural, remote districts. Once they get to their 11% cap, you take one high-need, high-cost student, a student who's medically fragile on a ventilator, and it is every bit as much of an impact as it is to a larger district. So they're not evenly distributed across the state. However, their impact can be pretty significant. We also found another phenomenon, and that's something that we've called cost shifting. Cost shifting has existed before the current economic crisis. If you look at the reductions and the eliminations of services that Department of Human Services have taken, especially in the area of mental health and medical supports, what happens when that's eliminated? Those students are not staying home. They are continuing to come to school, and it is the educational system that's being asked to pick up the support services for those students. In addition to that, we've also seen that since 1983, the legislature has set up a separate grant and aid fund to assist districts with excess costs for students who have what we call low-incident, high-need disabilities, students who are blind or deaf, or students who have autism, students who have severe orthopedic impairments. Because of the economic situation of the state, that grant and aid fund has continued to be reduced over the last several sessions. The mandates do not go away. The students are still there. The needs are there. What happens is it's a direct cost shift to the districts that have to pick it up. The other finding was that we've seen a significant demographic change in the state that reflects the national trend for an increase in the number of students who are culturally and linguistically diverse. And those students who are also eligible for special education have additional costs related to the language differences in terms of the evaluation, the interpreter, and the translation costs. There have been no additional revenue sources to assist districts as they deal with that. I'm going to take you now to there's a few other findings. One in particular that's been referenced before by Mr. Reeder was that the students with high need, high cost special ed services not evenly distributed across the state. The rest I'm sure that you can review at your leisure. Page 63 lists the recommendations. And based on the findings, one of the most significant recommendations that we had was to develop a two-tiered funding distribution formula that would include the percentage cap, and that percentage cap appears to be more closely related to a 13% rather than 11% based on the data, and the more recent data of December 1, this year's special ed count, corroborates that. But that there would be a differentiation in the weights. In other words, instead of every single special education student in the state receiving twice basic, that we look at perhaps a smaller weight for the higher incident, lower, the students that have mild to moderate service delivery needs, and that those students who have moderate to more severe service delivery needs, that there would be higher second weight that would be generated by that population. In addition to the two-tiered funding, that there be an extraordinary category or an extenuating circumstances category, that all of the exceptions would be in that category. For example, the out-of-state funding pool right now that consists of, I think it's about $800,000, that would be in that pot. If we did not have the 11% cap waiver process, it would put another $18 to $20 million using the current amount of money into that pot. That pot would be applied for as a district exceeded their 13% cap or whatever the percentage was that ended up being the final recommendation. They would apply for it on an expenditure-based process. In other words, they would have to demonstrate that their expenditures, less all available revenue resources, the federal resources, the ESD resources, would primarily be based on LEA funds. They would apply for this pool of money and would receive a proportionate reimbursement based on how much money was in that. So that was the best thinking of this particular subcommittee, and we thought that it would address the varying needs across the state. At that time, we didn't have the economic crisis we're facing at the moment, and you'll notice that Carolyn called your attention to the fact that you do not see the number one recommendation of this committee to give us more money. And at this point in time, it was probably, in retrospect, even a better decision than we thought. Given the additional funds, obviously, it would be helpful. You're looking at $56 million more expended than revenue source. More money would be helpful. However, the recommendation for the funding formula could be revenue neutral, if it had to be. And what it would do is it would redistribute some of the money in the pot to those districts who had the students with the more severe needs, higher cost needs.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Corcoran.
But it would also seem, I mean, you said that 160 some of the 198 are up to the 11% number now. Isn't it fair to assume that you'd see similar behavior in the next couple of years into the 13% bracket? And then wouldn't you just be, redistributing the money in such a way that it really wouldn't functionally be that different from what we're doing now? Other than you wouldn't show that subsidy or that difference in the amount of revenue
right.
needed for special ed?
Senator Ferrioli, Senator Corcoran, just like the 11% cap actually served its purpose for over 10 years, we believe that the 13% would be fairly stable, but it readjusts, it would reduce the number of districts that were requesting the waiver and allow the process for the expenditure special, whatever we call it, exceptional circumstances pot. Application process for that based on expenditure, we feel that it would change the current process.
The other question I have, even though I appreciate the fact that you were sensitive to the budget concerns of the state, when you say eliminate cost shifting of health-based and other support services, I mean, that's what we're doing. I mean, that's why we're, funding schools at the level we're funding schools because we're eliminating programs in mental health and health and all those other areas. So, and I mean, I'm not criticizing. I'm just pointing out that yes. unfortunately is what happens with general fund money. And I don't know how we get, how we adjust that. I mean, we should. There's a crying need to do that. And it's really apparent, in Cottage Grove, for instance, where they have a network of all the social services, public and private sector, in schools, and mental health provisions, and drug and alcohol, and all that relief nursery. I mean, you really see it. You see cost shifting in the room, because the service disappear over here, and school funding's cut over here. So, it's really a dilemma.
It is.
Senator, I think as a participant in the committee, there's something more fundamental going on here. I think we ought to just note what that is. In one case, it's the need for truth in funding for special education programs. We basically told people in the education system that they will receive a 2x multiplier for special education kids. And so there is a tremendous pressure put on people to identify special education kids because it means more resources for the school. And so there is, an identifiable issue there. The other issue is that we're letting the school department, schools and the education community pick up the slack or just receive the hit for underfunding special programs or healthcare programs in the community. So, if, you know, lacking these programs in the community, they simply enroll the kids in the school, knowing that the schools can't evade or escape the responsibility for special education funding, in some cases, fabulously expensive. So the question is, why are health care issues being displaced to the schools? And that is specifically what's going on in cost shifting. So this part of the task force's objective was simply to require the system to communicate back to the legislature, that's what's happening. You know, let's recognize what's going on. We're cost shifting from the health care system to the school department, to education systems. And continuing to do that is a failure to recognize the requirement in the health care system and bankrupting the schools. So I think there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in this committee that I think is rather courageous. It's cost us a couple of years to get to this point, and the committee really worked hard with these 11 recommendations. But I really believe that this cost-shifting issue and the way we incent the IEP programs are at the heart of recommendations for changing the funding formula and why we ought to change the funding formula. But I didn't mean to interrupt the committee and, or the presentation of the report.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think you're moving deck chairs. You know, I mean, if you have the same pot of money and you have these higher need, this small population of very high need folks, and I clearly understand how that drives it. But in the general population of, you know, if you could, you know, triage the needs and the costs and, you know, have a balance sheet of some sort, I still think that what happens is you're not given an extra dollar to the system. You're simply telling the system more directly that they have to appropriate, you know, now 13% instead of 11% of what the state gives them. You know, and I mean, I guess that's okay to bring it closer to reality, but it doesn't really solve anything in terms of the needs.
Well, I think you're right, Senator, that it doesn't really solve the problem, but I think we do have to start recognizing that schools are not healthcare delivery systems, and to create a system that causes them to accept a healthcare delivery system problem and call it education, that is irrational.
School-based health is the only place a bunch of these kids ever see a medical professional.
The apples and oranges, Senator, we're talking about kids that are profoundly disabled. It's a community health care problem. We're just moving them into the schools and calling it an educational issue. It's not an education issue. It's a health care issue. So the problem is we're not only not dealing with it at the community level, and I think we agree, you and I at least, that we're not dealing with it there. We're also not very effectively dealing with it at the school level, because we're potentially bankrupting the school districts by displacing those costs. In terms of rearranging deck chairs, I think we probably are, but at least we better start recognizing where the displaced costs are coming from and stop calling it education if it's basically health care. And some of our kids in those schools are going to be with us till age 21, and they are extremely expensive. We're seeing a cost shift to the more populated urban areas because the rural communities don't have the kind of medical or health care services needed to cope with them. And so we are, in fact, moving deck chairs. We're moving kids and people. But we're calling it education. And in fact, it's not really education. It's a health care service. Anyway, let's get on to the report. There's a lot more recommendations here.
Thank you. I know you're well aware of the issue of increased IDEA federal funds, and we are soliciting the assistance of the legislature in doing all you can to continue to encourage the federal level to reach their promise from 1975.
Well, we're kind of busy, I'm sorry, giving away large tax breaks and incentives and that sort of thing. We don't really have enough time to do that. And we have this war on tourism, so you know, between those two things, we don't have money.
We were also recommending that the special purpose fund targeted to protect districts from high cost excess services that the formula would not address. That currently is the fund in grant and aid that covers long-term care and treatment programs, the state schools, hospital programs, and regional programs be continued. And that, in essence, constitutes the recommendations of the committee. And I do appreciate the analogy of the rearrangement of deck chairs, because I'm afraid that it's true, the ship is definitely on fire. And if we don't move those chairs around, everyone will go down.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, I mean, I don't want to, I really do want to commend you guys for the work you did, because at least you give us a better way to quantify the problem. And instead of just, you know, it's been 11% for years, we'll just leave it at that, because every school district is going to move up to that portion to capture the revenue anyway. And, you know, there's all the dialogue in the community is, you know, the parents and grandparents of these special need kids have for years complained that, you know, their money just subsidized the rest of the school district, and then vice versa. You know, and I've got a, you know, very, very bright, the woman who runs special ed program South Lane, Sue Wickheiser, who I deeply respect, is telling me that, no, actually it's the other way around now. We don't have the resources in special ed itself. So that's good for this committee to struggle with in terms of, you know, we won't be able to come up with more revenue. That's the House job. But, you know, if it kind of sneaks over here, we'll do it. But at least we're getting, you know, clearer facts on. So I want to commend you guys for that.
Thank you.
Well, moreover, there were some specific recommendations relative to funding, how we fund and how we how we apportion the special education program. And maybe you could touch a little more on the recommendations of the committee relative to how we put together IEPs and what you're asking the committee to consider in terms of changes to the funding formulas.
Senator Farioli, member of the committee. In the section that looks at curriculum, part of our frame of reference being that we wanted to look at the complete comprehensive system, that what you find is there are, we've learned an awful lot about prevention and early intervention, and there are a significant number of students who, given the current system is they do not get intervention until they fail. Once they fail, they get an IEP, and then they're eligible for the special assistance they need. So there is a relatively recent school of thought that supports the need for early intervention, which then reduces the number of students who actually fail and then are later identified as being in need of special education. And those recommendations the chapter starts on page 19. So there would be significant opportunities in the general education population for addressing a lot of the needs of students who have learning problems and difficulty with reading that can be dealt with and help all students, as opposed to pulling out a select group of students. That is a far more cost-efficient way of addressing the issue. And again, then frees up existing dollars to go towards students with more significant needs. What's the probability that districts would find an incentive to over-identify students that have more severe needs? It's really difficult to misidentify a student who's deaf or hard of hearing, or visually impaired, or orthopedically impaired, or a student who has autism. So you're not going to find a monetary incentive that's going to allow districts to misidentify in those higher need categories in order to generate additional funds. We feel fairly confident of that. And again, there are all kinds of monitoring systems and auditing processes inherent with the Office of Special Education that precludes that from happening. So there would be a monitoring component available for that. So we wouldn't see it as being able to run away. We also recommended that there be a continuation of the funding subcommittee through the next biennium to begin to explore the DBI data more intensively and to come up with definitions and perhaps even work with the Quality Education Commission to look at the feasibility of a quality education model for special education costs. And I think those kinds of activities would address some of the concerns that you had.
Mr. Chair, I guess again, though, I would wonder, the early intervention makes total sense to me. You know, you see the work that the relief nurseries in Birth to Three, and then those guys do. They have these kids. They're basically the prep work for you guys, so you don't have to do it, because if they can get the kid ready to come into kindergarten, then it's not a kid that's going to be identified in special ed. But again, I mean, with limited resources, aren't you open to the criticism that whatever you're spending at the front end, you're not spending at the middle school and high school level for these special needs kids? I mean, if you have the same pot of money, makes sense that you would do early intervention. That's more resources that are going over there that can't go over to middle school or high school. Is that a danger as well?
Senator Farioli and Senator Corcoran, some of those early intervention services would happen in kindergarten, first and second grade, in terms of the additional emphasis on small group instruction and reading instruction for students who have the potential of acquiring learning disabilities. And so those tend to be able to be categorized in lower cost intervention services. So again, and you're talking right now, this year approximately 72% of the students identified fall into two higher incidence but mild to moderate disability areas, 72%. And if you look across the other categories and looked at students with lower service needs, it would fall approximately 85% of the population would fall into that more mild to moderate service category need, which, again, it's shifting the dollars for into the area that had the highest correlation of expenditure. That's about the best we could come up with in terms of all of the possibilities that we reviewed and studied.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thanks.
Further questions for the committee? I just want to make sure that the full import of some of the work of the report isn't being lost on the committee. There's an awful lot to digest here. What I'm going to do is accept the reports on 260 and 519, those two Senate bills from the previous legislative session, and this report to the Oregon Legislature on special education, and ask that the committee keep them upon the table and essentially so that we can talk about these more after having reviewed the reports. I think there's so much information here. We did have one other person that wished to address this issue. It's Steve Johnson. Would you like to go ahead and talk about this as well?
Thank you, Senator Farioli, Senator Corcoran, Steve Johnson, Associate Superintendent, Office of Special Education. There is little that I would want to add after the review of the task force, other than to first say thanks to all the members of the task force for the great work they did. And the department wants to give a special thanks to the four legislators who were assigned to the task force. They took their responsibility seriously. They reviewed the activities of the task force when they weren't able to attend, and when they were able to attend, they were fully participating. And those members were Senator Farioli, Senator Burdick, Representative Smith, and Representative Hobson, who did chair the committee. Would also like to note that Representative Backlund, who sponsored the legislation in the House, was frequently a guest and a participant at the task force meetings. The department took this task force very seriously, and we take their recommendations extremely seriously. We are working to implement many of the recommendations that were noted that were designed to have a no-cost or a low-cost requirement to them. We're pleased that many of these recommendations fall right in line with the No Child Left Behind legislation. And as difficult as that legislation is for any state, we believe it holds out promise in terms of prevention of over-identification of disability through increased attention to reading instruction, and that's part of the early intervention that Dr. Casey was speaking to. This year we're looking forward to the reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We believe that during this reauthorization debate, there will be attention paid to who are the children with learning disabilities. And there are many folks in this country who would like to narrow that definition, thus reducing the numbers of students in special education. That's great if the instruction is there to support the kids in the general classroom. And we believe that Oregon, the way it's working to commit no child to implement No Child Left Behind, is addressing this unified system of education that was spoken to by both of our task force members here, that all kids are part of the same system of education. We can't starve one part of education for the benefit of another. If there are children in great need, and there certainly are in this state, we need to attend to their needs, to the requirements, in order to make sure that they're able to succeed in life and become members of the community. As we do that, though, we need to make sure that the whole community of learners is supported. So I appreciate, Senator Ferrioli, your keeping this report on top of the table, and the department is also, and we look forward to opportunities to bring our progress in implementing these recommendations back to you. Thank you.
Senator Corcoran.
So, Dr. Case, I have one other question that crept up in the 2001 session that is related to this, and that's the incidence of autism. And what prompted it was this discussion that there was people who would like to narrow down the numbers of special ed and IEPs and thus narrow down the money, which I think my understanding was that at least certain types of autism were expanding and the definition of autism is expanded. And my sister-in-law is a speech pathologist in the Ben Lapine School District, and she said that the world's changed in 8 or 9 years in terms of reporting on autism. When you do the statistics that say that, you know, 80% of the kids would show up in not such a high maintenance mm-hmm. area, that's not true of autism, I would take it. And autism, can you sort of tell me what your hit on autism is? There's no altruism.
I'd like to give you my hit on altruism. Senator Ferrioli, Senator Corcoran, autism spectrum disorder is a full spectrum just like many other disabilities, in that there are a significant number of students with autism who are very high functioning and require some support, but not a whole lot of high cost intervention services. At the other end of the continuum are the very severe students with autism who have difficulty.
Is that an increasing population?
Yes, it is. The full autism spectrum disorder is increasing, but also the new category of higher functioning students with autism, that's increasing dramatically. So you'll find it across. They're not all at one end of the spectrum. They too would have students that required a lower level of instruction or intervention.
One final question. Are you finding any sort of geographical correlation with the incidence of autism?
Other than particular spots in the country, like small cities that have an incredible high incidence, not really. There's no single etiology. It's a combination. There's definitely a genetic factor that's been identified. However, we know that there are environmental causes and also metabolic causes. So it is a variety.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Is there anyone else here present that would like to make a comment on any of the reports before the committee? Please come forward. Mr. Rose.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Ozzie Rose, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and just a couple of comments. First, to the first study on the small schools and why we did it. If you recall, we did it in part. We asked for the study because we had a great debate over did we need to do some more for the small schools, and we made one temporary adjustment and said, let's do the study and see what it tells us. And I think it tells us some things that we should pay attention to. And I'm going to have that before my group of 40 superintendents next week. The special ed issue is also there in part because of the huge debate over the autism and what we needed to do, if you recall. And we've learned some things, and I think we have some answers that will be better answers. And again, I hope to come back to you and say I've got the school superintendents all in line on how we ought to make changes. Now, you know how that goes. Unfortunately, in our era of short resources, the forum is a great target for rearranging resources for that purpose alone. But there are some things here that I think deserve careful attention. And Senator Corcoran, you're correct. To some respect, it's rearranging some deck chairs. But if you go back to the principles of the formula, it talks about trying to take care of uncontrollable needs. And clearly, I think we can focus the money we got a little better than we are at the present time. We have lots better data than we had when we started out. The issue of over-identification, you recall, Dr. Casey told you that our 11% when time we did that was the same as the national average. The 13 is the same as, so I don't think I reject the argument that our people are out there willy-nilly identifying for financial purposes, and we've tried to create a form that didn't promote that, and I don't think that's happening. But we can do a better job of targeting than when we did when we started. 2 points was about the average, and it worked da-da-da. We have a lot better data now, and that's all that this effort is aimed at, is trying to follow the principles of the formula.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Ozzie, so I asked Brian this question earlier about is there a way, I know we've talked about not, you know, the desire in the building by a lot of people not to present members of the committee who aren't here excluded, to talk about messing with the school funding formula, but I did have the superintendent, Dennis, from Roseburg telling me, or the ESD superintendent down there, Dennis Douglas, that when they looked at this merger between two small schools down in small school districts, North Douglas and Yoncalla, that they ran into this problem because they were in part of that intending to create just one high school, that they would end up losing $250,000, so they stopped the discussion. But it seemed to me that there should have been some sort of no disincentive, not necessarily an incentive, but no disincentive not to merge.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, now I'm just talking from my point of view, not anybody else's, but there are situations where people have made decisions to not combine, not maybe across district, but even buildings within a district because of the small school. I think we need to look at, can we create some incentives? If it creates better programs, it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And the one you're talking about, I would guess it might have created a better cohort or better mass for a better program. And if that got in the way, we ought to try to undo that in a way that would be positive rather than negative. I hadn't heard about that specific one, but that concept needs to be looked at.
Sure.
I also say about the formula, maybe you were here the other day when we talked about the growth bills. With all the respect, everybody's opinion on how the formula is or isn't and who we've helped and who we haven't, we've only made two permanent changes to the formula. One was to try to address the facility demands of the growth districts because they can't bond for the things they used to, and the other was the remote and small school issues. So with all our debate and all of the different lobbyists and all the stuff, I think that you've done a pretty decent job at trying to manage that, in an era where we try to create equity with no extra money, which nobody else is trying to do that.
Just to revisit the issue of the moving chairs on the deck, in the bigger picture, you're probably right. But I do agree with what Mr. Rose is saying. This report talks about a more efficient way of determining need and a more efficient way of matching the need to the resources. And the ultimate result of that will be to put in perspective what the greater need is, I mean, for the individual education program or the individual that has profound needs, and put more resources available to that need. Stopping losses for school district, but also recognizing that the current formula would recognize a student on an independent education program for a minor or a relatively minor learning disability, like a reading comprehension problem, that could be addressable with maybe 3 or 4 hours a week or even less of remediation and consult in the same category as it would a person with a far more profoundly affected disability. And to indicate in the weighting of the formula that those things are co-equal is probably inaccurate. In one case, it creates far more than the needed funding stream. In another case, it doesn't begin to deal with it. So the question is, couldn't we try to inject some kind of a truth in education programs so that the dollars actually go to the children with greater need, and the school district at some point in time has a stop loss? And so that's more than just rearranging deck chairs on a sinking boat. That's trying to match need and resources. So I do think there's some benefit in this report that's far more critical and possibly demands a lot more attention than just saying, hey, we ought to fully fund education, and that's the real problem. Even if we fully funded education, these kinds of adjustment would be necessary. So I'm hoping we can do more with the task force report than just receive it and call it a good thing and stick it on the shelf.
Their final recommendation, Mr. Chair, was to add 5 more pages to the IEPs.
Well, that will happen inevitably. We are at the end of our hearing. I think it was very important and interesting to have these bills. I think they're going to remain on the table until we can get the chair and the rest of the committee to also review them. We're closed for today.